Welcome to the world today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Tuesday, the increasing urgency in the calls from supporters of a no-fly zone for Libya as casualties among rebel fighters soar. And in Japan, aid and emergency workers grapple with an almost overwhelming disaster. We talk to our correspondent in the disaster zone.
I can't imagine how people would still be alive now, because for a while they thought people were cut off when the tsunami came in and they were sort of winching them out by helicopter. But, you know, the hope that people would now still be somewhere in amongst all that tangled mess. I think they would be thinking there are not going to be many more rescues from now on.
More on the stories of survival and the clean-up in Japan shortly, but as we go to air, authorities are once again focused on the threat of a potential nuclear disaster. This morning, there was another explosion at the Fukushima nuclear plant, which was badly damaged in last Friday's powerful earthquake and tsunami. While agencies say the roof of the number 2 reactor was damaged, radiation levels in the air surrounding the plant have risen fourfold, and workers have been ordered to leave parts of the plant. Authorities are now scrambling to prevent meltdowns in 3 of the plant's 4 nuclear reactors. It's the third time a blast has been recorded at the site, but local authorities insist the reactor containment vessels were not damaged. Our correspondent in Tokyo, Hayden Cooper, joins us now with the latest. So Hayden, what is the country's nuclear safety agency saying now about the risks?
Well, they agree with many other people that this is potentially a very serious development. What has happened is that, unlike the other two explosions, this explosion happened much closer to the container structure that protects the reactor core. Now, it happened somewhere called the suppression pool or suppression chamber. That's at the bottom of the reactor core, and the very real fear seems to be that this blast could have damaged either the walls of the suppression pool or the walls of the container structure itself, and that would be the first time that that has happened since the earthquake, and it would open up the possibility of a much more serious leak of radiation, either radioactive liquid in the water or radioactive gas.
Hayden, why are authorities thinking that this may have breached the container wall this time?
Well, because this time the blast was actually heard in the vicinity of this suppression chamber. So it's somewhere inside, near the container structure. That's what they're worried about. In the previous two examples, the hydrogen explosions blew apart the building that houses the reactor, but the reactor container structure itself wasn't damaged. So this time around, things could be different, but we don't have confirmation of that yet. That's what we're waiting for.
Now, I understand that the Tokyo Electric Power Company broke the news.
They did. They have held a press conference and actually apologised to the Japanese public for the incident and for the concern that they are causing. They are not releasing all the details just yet, and they did experience a fair degree of frustration on behalf of from the reporters who were questioning them about what actually happened. Let's have a listen now.
This morning, from 6 to 6:15, there was a big explosive impact. Around 6:14, we heard a strange sound around the suppression pool, or rather, and the pressure changed. The pressure control area. We have experienced some kind of problem, and we will continue our efforts to inject water into the reactor pressure vessel. Our staff temporarily has evacuated to 1F or outside of the 1F. We have asked them to evacuate for their safety. In 1F, the remaining staff are working to secure safety.
And that's part of the press conference given by officials from the Tokyo Electric Power Company. Hayden, has the government tried to calm the population there? Is there a sense of panic there in Tokyo?
Not in Tokyo, but closer to Fukushima for sure. Japanese television has been playing comments from people who are about 40 kilometres from the plant. Remember, the explosion zone is at 20, but still the people who have evacuated beyond that explosion zone are extremely worried about what the consequences might be. And the reports suggest that they are gathering around televisions inside and that they are very scared about what might happen. So There is a feeling of dread to some extent, not in Tokyo, but definitely closer to Fukushima.
Now, Tokyo is 250 kilometres away, but in the capital there, is there a different feeling today from the response to those previous explosions?
Well, this one does seem to be a lot more serious. In the previous cases, the government and the authorities came out very quickly and said that the reactor core itself was not damaged and that there was no damage to the container housing it. In this case, it just seems a little bit unclear at this point as to what the damage may be. Part of the reason for that is because they evacuated straight away after the explosion, and we're not even sure if they're back in there yet to try and ascertain how serious the damage is and whether or not the wall of the container structure has any cracks in it.
So the government's not coming out quickly to say one way or another how the public should be reacting to this?
Well, it all seems a little bit uncertain at the moment, but I would imagine that the government spokesman will speak fairly soon. He's been holding very regular press briefings throughout this whole disaster, and today I'm sure would be no exception.
Do people tend to trust what the government tells them on these issues?
I think there is a growing sense of scepticism. While the government's response has drawn some praise in many quarters, there is a feeling that perhaps they're not communicating quite as well as they could. And in this case, as I mentioned before, Tokyo Electric Power Company, which runs Fukushima, held a press conference to explain what happened. But at the end of the press conference, it wasn't entirely clear why the explosion had happened and what parts of it of the reactor had been damaged. So, yeah, there certainly is a growing sense of scepticism.
Hayden Cooper, our correspondent there in Tokyo, thank you. Well, Dr. John Price is a former member of the Safety Policy Unit of the National Nuclear Corporation in the UK and a former professor at Monash University. He's now a private consultant and he joins us to talk about this latest explosion. Dr. Price, thanks for joining us. How concerned are you about what you're hearing about this latest blast?
Well, it does sound to me as though they're talking about damage to the valves on the outlet of the containment vessel. That's all I'm getting at the moment. The reason that they're saying that is because they don't seem to be able to maintain the normal pressure in the bow inside the vessel. Now, whether that's a permanent problem or whether it really matters, I'm not too certain.
How serious could it be if that container vessel is damaged?
Well, it's not the vessel itself, I don't think. I think we're talking about some valves on the end of the suppression tank. I think is, say, vent steam from it. The steam goes into this to a water tank. So I think we're just talking about some valves on the outlet. I think there was an explosion. There was an explosion there, wasn't there? This is Unit 2.
There was certainly an explosion, and it was apparently bigger than the other explosions that we've
seen. I think I've seen some video of it. It looked very similar to the one in 3 yesterday, which was a hydrogen explosion. I think a lot of the same than what I saw. It appears as though there has been hydrogen collecting in the plant, and it seems to have exploded, and it's wrong. So then the question is, why, if that happens, they've now got a new lot of damage inside the plant, which they're attempting to cope with, and how hardened it is against explosion is the next question.
Well, the workers have been told to leave the plant. Does that indicate this may be more serious than the government had suggested previously? Who's now going to be attempting to cool these reactors?
Well, I took that comment to make that they were going to retreat to the emergency control site. That won't be there.
So they will still be able to control the cooling operation or the attempt to cool it?
That's right. They will have some control. And the emergency control system is supposed to handle accidents, and that's what's going on at the moment.
There seems to have been an admission that there has probably been a partial meltdown in some of the reactors in this Fukushima plant. What sort of dangers are we talking about with a partial or indeed a full meltdown?
Well, the full meltdown, I think, is going to be quite impossible because I think that happens in the first day or two. Shutdown fails right at the beginning of the incident. We're now 4 days away, and the core will be a great deal cooler. However, there may be bits of pieces which are not being in contact with the water and not being cooled by the water adequately. And that's why we're worried about the water level falling. And this particular reactor, Unit 2, has a debate about the water level meter. They're saying they don't know whether it's working.
And if the water level falls, what then?
If the water level falls, then the reactor becomes exposed and continues to heat up. Now, in the terms of melting, I don't really know whether that's going to happen. I think if bits and pieces melt, they'll drop into the water and just solidify, but I don't know. We're getting into... I don't know. We're now starting into the core physics, and I'm afraid core physics isn't quite my area.
Is there a danger, though? Is there a significant danger for people in the vicinity, and how far could any nuclear contamination spread?
Well, if it releases to the atmosphere, the question is going to be whether it releases solid particles. If it releases lots of solid particles, they're carried in the air. And if the air, I just read a report from the IAEA, which says the air is directed offshore, I think, for the next 3 days. But anyway, that's what we have. That's the next step we're worried about.
Dr. John Price, thanks very much for joining us.
Bye.
That's Dr. John Price. He's a former member of the Safety Policy Unit at the National Nuclear Corporation in the UK. Well, as we've been hearing, around 80,000 people have been evacuated from the exclusion zone around the stricken nuclear power plants. Another 450,000 people have been forced from their homes nationwide because of the tsunami and earthquake. Strong aftershocks persist across the region. Almost 2 million households are without power in the freezing north, and about as many have no running water. Stephen McDonnell is in the Miyagi Prefecture, one of the worst affected, and I spoke to him from there a short time ago. Well, Steve, you're still in Miyagi. What are the conditions like there today?
Well, it's actually gotten worse for rescue workers here today because, as well as having to move around places where the roads have been blocked, get through rubble and trees and bits of cars and that to try and do their job, it's now raining and really cold here. So they've got to try and move through the rain and operate in the cold. So it's becoming very hard for workers here.
So what are authorities telling you about their hopes of finding anyone alive in those sorts of conditions?
It doesn't look like they think they're going to find anyone else, and pretty much it's moving the dead. I can't imagine how people would still be alive now, because for a while there were people who were cut off when the tsunami came in, and they were sort of winching them out by helicopter. But, you know, the hope that people would now still be somewhere in amongst all that tangled mess, I think they would be thinking they're not going to be many more rescues from now on.
Stephen, there was that horrific discovery by rescue workers yesterday of 2,000 bodies on that beach. Have there been any more discoveries like that?
Well, that was the terrible one, of course. That's a beach right near where I'm standing. And what's obviously happened is, I'm guessing what's happened is that the tsunami's come in and washed those people back out to sea and then plunked them back down again on the beach. Normally, it hasn't been a case of finding that many people clumped together, but it's more of a task of getting around this mess that used to be people's towns, and bit by bit, you know, identifying someone, oh, there's a body, whatever. But we were walking around last night through all this, and I was talking to the ABC cameraman, and he was just thinking, there could be people where we're standing, you wouldn't know. It's just such a tangled mess. Imagine if you're in a real scrubby bush and bits of trees and bent over houses. You wouldn't know where anybody was caught in this tsunami. So the process of actually finding people's bodies is going to be really tough.
Are there any locals there actually trying to get back to their homes?
Well, there are the odd people you see who've been able to make it back to their houses. And we, you know, they're growing just a few personal effects out of the ruins of where they used to live, that sort of thing. Because I'd imagine, why would anyone want to do that? But you do see stuff that they want to hang on to. I mean, for example, we were walking through the devastated part of what used to be a town, and there's just stuff everywhere. And I picked up a book of wedding photos, and we've given them to the authorities in case the person comes back. So you can imagine that that is the sort of thing that people might want to try and find. There's just nothing left of their house to speak of.
What about those people who did survive the tsunami and are now facing the shortages of food and water there? Is anything getting through to alleviate those shortages?
If you were in the areas which are, say, within an area of between the coast 7 kilometres inland, you wouldn't be able to get anything like food or water or anything like that. So rescue workers, army, Japan's self-defence force, people, they've obviously got their own supplies. Basically, it's deserted in there, other than rescue workers.
What about those emergency workers and Red Cross and so on? Are they able to get supplies in there?
Well, emergency workers are able to chopper stuff in, so they're running these emergency shelters. They've got their own supplies of food and water, so if people have been lucky enough to make an evacuation centre, they can be looked after there. But you wouldn't want to be out in the elements today, in the freezing cold, in the rain, with no power, with no water, with no food. And there's no sign that anytime soon the power is going to come back on here. I mean, this place is so smashed up, apart from the fact that I think it's going to be years until they can move people back into those towns in that 7 kilometre wide strip on the coast. That's going to take a long time to be rebuilt. It's just been so smashed up. But in the bigger areas, in the cities that are further inland in Miyagi Prefecture, I don't know when the power's going to come back on. And eventually, it's going to be a really tough thing for the Japanese authorities to manage. I mean, there are whole cities without power, without water.
That's our correspondent Stephen McDonald in the Miyagi Prefecture. Well, as we've been hearing, a lack of fuel and cold weather in the areas hardest hit by the disaster is proving to be among the biggest challenges for aid organisations. It's now 4 days since the earthquake, and the Red Cross estimates that 430,000 people are in emergency accommodation. Sarah Hawke reports on the challenge facing aid workers. The Red Cross now has 85 medical teams in some of the hardest hit areas. There are teams operating in Otoshi in the Iwate Prefecture on the northeast coast. Speaking on satellite phone from Otoshi, Red Cross spokesman Patrick Fuller says the area is devastated.
Population 17,000 is now believed. There's 9,500 people still unaccounted for. The town is flattened. There's only a few buildings standing, and it's just a mass of twisted debris, and the emergency services trying to clear the roads and recover bodies and any survivors, but it's doubtful at this point whether there's survivors left.
The relief efforts are being compounded by freezing conditions. The Red Cross medical staff are reporting cases of hypothermia.
It's extremely cold. I mean, it's below zero. Last night was very, very cold. It's trying to snow at the moment, so it's not easy. I mean, the concern is obviously for the people who survived, who are living in temporary evacuation centres and schools here, and people still able to live in their homes. You know, there's no electricity, there's no running water, and the government's doing its best to reposition or reprovision some of the shops with food. And there's long queues of local people just waiting to see sort of what might be on sale. So, you know, one of the problems is logistical access, getting resupplied, as it were.
In fact, with the extremely cold weather there and electricity not particularly good, how difficult is that making the task?
Very challenging. I mean, you know, we're staying in a tent, and as are most of the rescue workers here, and it's tough, but it's much tougher for the local people. You know, some of whom were actually caught in the tsunami, so, you know, they've been exposed to the water, they've inhaled a lot of contaminated water, so they've got, you know, respiratory problems. Sort of one of the big concerns is obviously pneumonia for people like that.
World Vision is also grappling with logistical challenges. World Vision has a team in the city of Sendai assessing where they can provide assistance. Spokeswoman Mitsuko Sabata says the team is wanting to take 4,500 blankets and thousands of bottles of water about 100 kilometres north to Tomei.
Because they say that it's 6,000 people who have lost their homes and now staying at
temporary places like communities or schools, and they say that there are a lot of children and babies and women who need the essential items.
And while there's a desperate need for supplies, they still have to come in from Tokyo. Road access means the supplies won't arrive in Sendai until later today. The next challenge is trucking the blankets north to Tome.
As usual, it takes 1 or 1.5 hours to get there, if we can use the highway, but we are not sure. But if the highway is damaged, we have to go to the shops, we have to go through the small way, so it takes more time.
The other logistical problem is fuel. Fuel has been rationed, and there have been long queues outside petrol stations in Sendai. World Vision is now assessing how it will roll out its operations over the next few days in the light of the lack of fuel.
Because we don't have the enough gasoline for our vehicle, actually. We cannot buy enough gasoline, not even in affected area, but also another area than the town. We have to go through like 100 kilometers or 200 kilometers to get the affected area. So we have to do a detailed plan. Otherwise, we will be lost.
That's Mitako Sabato from World Vision speaking to Sarah Hawke. With the death toll in Japan now expected to exceed 10,000, many survivors are searching in vain for friends and relatives. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says there are no reports of Australian casualties, but many families here are still waiting to speak to their loved ones, as Samantha Donovan reports.
Survivors of the disaster continue to search for missing family and friends. Teiko Yagashi went to her brother's house in Natori. There was nothing left.
I have no more tears. I have cried them all. I went to all the evacuation centers, but I couldn't find him. Still, I'm thinking he must be somewhere.
Yasunobu Matsura is a local firefighter trying to put aside his feelings as he works.
In this disaster, numerous local residents were affected.
But there were many too who lost their lives trying to protect them. When I think of them, it chokes me with sadness.
North of Natori is Rikuzata Kata, once home to 24,000 people. It's been flattened and 18,000 people are missing. One of the few survivors is Masahiro Iwabe. He made it to the roof of his three-story building and watched the tsunami destroy everything around him.
The houses were swallowed up by the wave, and then they started floating past. As the buildings were destroyed, black dusty smoke was thrown up, and then the tsunami swallowed up the smoke as well. At first I thought almost everyone was dead, but gradually I found my family and friends alive. I began to hope maybe half of the missing had survived.
The Department of Foreign Affairs says 129 Australians in the affected areas have been confirmed as safe. Many of them are stranded, though, and unable to make contact with family here. Sydney sider Ashley Russell hasn't been able to speak to his 21-year-old daughter since the earthquake. Alice Byron has been teaching in Ofanato in Iwate province for nearly a year. Mr. Russell knows his daughter is at the devastated town's evacuation centre, but that news only came through after a cruel hoax.
We had a dreadful Friday and Saturday, not knowing, you know, where she was. We put her up on the Google missing persons list only to hear someone had posted that she was confirmed dead. And we had some friends who frantically rang around in Japan at that hospital, and someone had posted that as a troll-style message. So that was fairly devastating.
As a what-style message?
A troll-style message. Someone had just put a fake message up saying that she was confirmed dead, but they'd given the number of a real hospital in the area.
Why would someone do that?
There were some evil people out there. And her employer said other people had put that up on other people that were missing, had also used the Google site for that. And then when we were still sort of giving up hope on Saturday night, thinking the worst had happened, we had a sat-nav email out of the blue from her. Somehow she'd got hold of a sat-nav phone with email connectivity, and sent us a note saying, safe, evacuated to Town Hall Centre, love you. that was that. And then on Sunday morning we had a call from DFAS, who I must say have been absolutely fantastic. They were able to somehow get a line into, or she got a line out of Ofanato Town Hall Centre to say that, you know, she was there safe but wanting to get out. And I think that in Katie's case, I think she's one of the few English people, English-speaking people in the town. And she's been teaching her kids there, and the primary school kids. And from what DFAT said, that you know, she's with parents that have lost children, and with children who have lost parents in the centre. So,
what would it mean to you to hear her voice?
I think you can probably hear the emotion in my voice. I'd be very grateful.
What now can be done? Is DFAT doing anything? Is there anything the family can do to get
her out? DFAT has, as I said, they've kept us up to date. They told us they had a team of consular officials sort of moving up from Sendai, and I think with the plan of sort of getting to all the little towns and hospitals along the way, and they will ideally, you know, get her and get her out. From what we gather, is you sort of can't move in or out of these towns.
That's Sydney Father Ashley Russell speaking to Samantha Donovan. Through ABC Radio and Radio Australia, streaming live on our website and via podcast, this is The World Today. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And still to come on the program, as thousands of foreign troops march into Bahrain at the request of the government, we speak to an opposition leader who says this won't scare protesters off the streets.
There is no legitimacy in calling them. You know, this government is not legitimate right now, because this is the government that's killing its people. This government, if it goes to polls, it will lose, you know, mandate. It's not an elected government anyway. These people are brought to suppress the population, and the population have the right to call them a foreign occupying force.
More from Bahrain shortly, but first, there's a growing sense of urgency among supporters of a no-fly zone for Libya. The UN Security Council met overnight to consider a resolution, but as yet it hasn't made a decision. In France, a meeting of the G8 foreign ministers is also discussing the situation. And in Washington, US President Barack Obama has called for an end to President Gaddafi's rule, but has not indicated how that should be carried out. And in Libya's east, Libyans opposed to the regime continue to engage in bloody battles with pro-Gaddafi forces, as Michael Vincent reports.
The reports from the front line are confusing. Both sides claim to have taken the town of Braga in the past 24 hours. The only certainty is that rebel casualties continue to mount. Mohammed bin Saleh was injured in the fighting and hasn't been seen for 2 days. His family is sure that he's dead. Back in Benghazi, his father Osama is receiving mourners at a traditional tent set up to celebrate his son's life.
Very wonderful son, you know. I couldn't wish for a better son like my son.
Can you tell me about what happened?
It was near sunset, and it was fire all over the place, and confusion and fear. His friend, he said to me, you know, all I know that he was injured and he fell down. But, you know, other than that, he doesn't know.
So he was either shot or injured by a shrapnel?
Yes. And the sad story, there is no news up to now. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, I think he's dead because nobody survived under their hand.
Mohammed bin Saleh was 21 years old. He was a volunteer who'd come to Libya from the US. His father, Osama, used to run an import-export business in the US state of Virginia. Now he finds himself part of the rebel medical team. After what happened to his son, he says he was tempted to take up a weapon and fight.
This is a decision that it's in my mind, yes, absolutely. And the doctor, they looked at me and they said, please, Osama, you know, we don't want to lose you. We can see in your eye, you know, what you are thinking. But for us, you being alive is better than you are dead, you know. But I will not let my son's death go in vain, I promise you that.
And it appears many more parents are preparing for the worst, especially when fighting reaches the city of Ras Dabia. General Abdel Fattah Yunus was Colonel Gaddafi's former interior minister and is now the rebels' senior commander. He says the war is entering a crucial phase.
The battle for Ajdabia is very important to us. We feel that the enemy will have serious logistical problems in supplying their troops.
Outside Libya, diplomatic talks continue. In France, a meeting of G8 ministers is expected to discuss a no-fly zone. But already Japan has said some sort of justification, such as a UN Security Council resolution, is needed. And pressure is on the UN body to act urgently. Lebanon's ambassador to the UN, Nawaf Salam, is the only representative from an Arab country on the Security Council.
We are going to work hard for a resolution. We think it's not only illegitimate request, it's a necessary request. Measures ought to be taken to stop the violence, to put an end to the deterring situation in Libya, to protect the civilians.
The UN has sent a representative to Libya to discuss the humanitarian situation there. But as the death toll rises, the UN is under pressure to act. Farhan Haq is a spokesman for the Secretary-General, Ban Ki-moon.
He believes that the violence in Libya must be halted, and whatever pressure can be brought to bear on the various parties on the ground to get them to halt the fighting, he wants that to be accomplished fairly soon, given the tremendous humanitarian impact we've seen.
Libya is not the only cause for concern in the Arab world. Overnight, Saudi Arabia deployed its forces to the neighboring state of Bahrain to bolster government forces there against opposition protests. It's a move that's caught US defense officials by surprise. Defense Secretary Robert Gates was in the region last week. The Pentagon has been forced to say that none of their top military heads had prior knowledge of the Saudi deployment, despite them being a close ally.
Michael Vincent reporting. Well, let's go now to Bahrain, and despite the government killing several protesters last month, demonstrations have continued to clog the streets. Yesterday, as we heard, the King of Bahrain called for assistance from the Gulf Cooperation Council, and troops from Saudi Arabia and other regional countries are now being deployed to the tiny Arab country. The government says it needs the foreign troops to keep the peace. The United States administration is expressing concern, but says this is not an invasion. But the key opposition leader, the Secretary-General of Bahrain's secularist Wahd Party, Ebrahim Sharif, disagrees. And he says that if the royal family does not agree to negotiate to bring democracy to the country, it will have to order the troops to fire on protesters to stop them taking to the streets. We first spoke to Ebrahim Sharif shortly after the protests began in February. He spoke to me from Bahrain again this morning. Ebrahim Sharif, what's your reaction to the King's call for help from the Gulf Cooperation Council to deal with the unrest in your country?
There is no legitimacy in calling them. You know, this government is not legitimate right now, because this is the government that's killing its people. This government, if it goes to polls, it will lose, mandate. It's not an elected government anyway. These people are both to support the population, and the population have the right to call them a foreign occupying force.
What's your estimate of the number of foreign troops now in your country, and what countries are they from?
The number of people, vehicles we have seen moving through the causeway between Saudi and Bahrain is very large, right? There must be a few thousand people moved in. I hear a figure of 10,000. And 10,000 in Bahrain is a lot of figure. I mean, this is a local population of 570,000. 10,000 troops is like having a million troops probably in the U.S.
A spokesman for the Bahrain Interior Ministry said that the reason the forces have been brought in is that the protests are no longer peaceful, that protesters are now targeting security forces.
That's not correct. There is not a single death in the security forces, and the number of injuries the protesters have is roughly about 100 to 1. There is a mass number of people demonstrating. They have not used any weaponry. The only way to face the military or to face the police is by having these young people bare-chested, basically confronting the police line. It is their sheer number that puts fear in the sheer number and courage that puts fear in policemen.
Will people be scared off the streets by these forces?
No, they are not. There is a lot of courage, and people are willing to die for the cause. I don't know what kind of weaponry they will use. If they're going to use machine guns to kill people, they probably will be able to kill a lot of people to prevent them from going to the street. But what's happening since last night is very worrying, actually, for the last 2 days. The government has been using these state funds, and they go and attack villages and shoot at people. I went to the hospital just half an hour ago. They had five or six people. This is one hospital with buckshots. and two of them in critical condition with head injuries from a very short distance. I think what they want to say, they want to put fear, distill fear in people's hearts.
And so do you think that with these foreign forces, the violence will escalate?
Yes, if the foreign forces are used to suppress the people of Bahrain, they will definitely be escalating. Otherwise, there is no point of bringing them in. And it is sort of a threatening, if you don't come to a dinner table, we're going to call in outside troops.
Last time we spoke, you were in negotiation with the Crown Prince, and the Crown Prince said on the weekend that talks would address key opposition demands. Are you still prepared to participate in those talks?
We are prepared in participating in the talks, but we have said talks are based on democratic principles. We need an acknowledgement from the state saying an elected government will come based on one man, one vote, and we'll have a new constitution. We said these are principles of democratic countries. We can discuss details, we can discuss schedules, but these are non-negotiables. I mean, we don't have a mandate from the people to say to the government, yes, we want half democracy or quarter democracy. And then people have the right to refuse us as leaders. We don't have a mandate to negotiate anything less than a proper functioning democratic system.
The Crown Prince says that he did offer major concessions on the weekend, effectively a constitutional monarchy. Isn't that fulfilling the key demand of the protesters?
No. Well, they have been saying that we have a constitutional monarchy for the last 10 years. They have none of that. Their definition of constitutional monarchy is a monarchy which has a constitution. It's about accepting the principle that the people of Bahrain have the right to have an elected government. Some of us believe that with foreign troops here, we should not negotiate because it's just like we are being coerced into negotiation. I think the fact that foreign troops here, the government may think that they are in a better negotiation position, but it's definitely not going to affect the way we look at things. If we can't get a deal based on democratic principles, we're not going to go. Even if the occupation force is here, even if they suppress the people. And I think the ruling family does not realize we will persevere, and you will have to basically suppress us. And the government probably has to kill a lot many people. And we would never say, yes to the occupation. We never say yes to this coercion.
So you're prepared to see more Bahrainis killed?
No, we're not prepared to see more Bahrainis killed. Bahrainis are willing to give their life despite what we tell them.
And they're going to listen to us, go home or not go to home.
They're going to say this is something. This movement was not started by political organization. This movement was started by young people on the internet. And we have no right to deprive these people of their right to see this going to the proper end, and the proper end is full freedom, not half freedom. And they have the right to say, you have no mandate, we're going to fight to the end, peacefully.
That's the Secretary General of Bahrain's secularist Wahd Party, Ebrahim Sharif. You can hear a longer version of that interview on our website, where he talks about the US response. The Reserve Bank has signalled that the Queensland floods earlier this year could put a bigger dent into the economic growth than it first expected. The minutes from the RBA's March meeting are now adding to speculation that the next official GDP reading could be negative. The board said that developed economies were recovering from the global financial crisis, but that optimism was expressed before the disaster in Japan. Business editor Peter Ryan has been at the RBA's headquarters in Sydney this morning, and he joins us now. So, Peter, to what extent will the disaster in Japan change the Reserve Bank's outlook on the global economic recovery?
Well, Eleanor, as you said, these minutes are based on a monthly meeting held a fortnight ago when rates were kept on hold at 4.75%. And that was actually quite a different world a fortnight ago. Back then, the board noted that output in Asia had been expanding at a solid pace, with the exception of Japan, where private consumption and consumer sentiment was down sharply, and note that was before the earthquake and tsunamis. But even then, it did make the point that industrial production was picking up in Japan. In late 2010 and early 2011, there were signs of new momentum. Now, obviously, the outlook has been superseded by the earthquake, which halted a lot of industrial production, and of course, the nuclear emergency means little power, or at least at best ration. So there's no doubt that Japan is now in a deeper economic hole than it was before, and that the recovery from a very long period of stagnation will be a whole lot tougher.
So did the RBA officials there give any indication of how much the growth forecast might change given the situation in Japan?
Well, they weren't commenting on the current situation, but today at another event that coincided with the release of the RBA minutes, and Assistant Governor Guy DeBell was asked about his view on the situation in Japan, and he refused to comment. So the view there would be that the RBA is now reassessing where everything stands. They'll be in a wait-and-see situation to see what this means for the global economy and also perhaps for what it means for the Australian economy. So no update, but clearly the Reserve Bank has been and will be monitoring the situation for a long time until all the facts are on the table.
Now, what about more local concerns? What did the Reserve Bank Board have to say about the damage done to their economic growth by the Queensland floods?
Well, they've commented in the previous statement about the impact of the Queensland floods, but they did say that this time around that the impact of the floods had become much more evident in the flow of data that we've been speaking about on this program over the last week or so. It did say that Reserve Bank staff expect the floods could take half a percentage point off growth in the March quarter. That's the next GDP reading. The RBA, though, has noted problems in the recovery in Queensland, and that's to do with the dewatering of coal mines, which have been flooded, and they believe that means that the risk of a worse-than-expected result is a possibility. So on top of the hit to agricultural production, there's that issue of really getting the coal mines back in action, all that water taken out. So it still says, the RBA still says the impact on the wider national economy will be small when it comes to Queensland, but economists believe that that could actually add up to possibly a negative result in the next reading.
And just very briefly, Peter, the outlook for interest rates?
The reading today is that the rate's on hold for the foreseeable future. The Reserve Bank believes that the home loan rates are above average, but the policy is mildly restrictive, so that means that rates are certainly on hold for the foreseeable future, and some economists believe perhaps until the end of the year.
Peter Ryan, our business editor. Thank you. An Australian National University report says a price on carbon may have to be set at $60 a tonne if it's to drive down Australia's greenhouse gas emissions. The study also calls for the government to prioritise income tax cuts over industry assistance. The government won't endorse the report's findings, but it welcomes discussion about the issue. In Canberra, Naomi Woodley reports.
Dr. Frank Yotso is the director of the Centre for Climate, Economics and Policy at the Australian National University's Crawford School. His latest paper on carbon pricing is released today, and in his view, the government's decision to pursue a carbon tax followed by an emissions trading scheme should keep the economic impact of introducing a carbon price manageable.
What we have on the table now in terms of the phased carbon pricing approach with a fixed price or tax first, and that then morphing into emissions trading later on, in my analysis, certainly is the most viable model to go forward, given the international uncertainties and given the domestic policies and the interest of the key domestic stakeholders.
But Dr. Yotso says given the pace of economic and resources growth in Australia, any future carbon price would have to be set at around $50 to $60 a tonne to turn around Australia's increasing emissions.
The price will have to increase at a reasonably steady pace in order to get Australia's emissions trajectory bending down rather than keep going up as is the underlying trend. It may have to rise to perhaps twice the level of carbon prices that are currently in the discussion for the starting price by the end of the decade.
He says it doesn't have to be a price shock.
The beauty of the approach that's on the table now is that you can start with a moderate price and demonstrate that carbon pricing doesn't mean any kind of economic catastrophe or anything like that. So economic impacts, business impacts will be manageable and we can ramp up from there.
Dr. Yotso says despite vocal campaigns from industry groups, the government should focus on using the revenue earned by the carbon price to make cuts in income tax or increases in social security payments.
The important thing in the end is that the total amount of income tax paid goes down. That's really the best way of giving that that assistance to households. What exact purpose in the tax code you use for that is to an extent secondary, as long as the incentive to cut back on energy use and cut back on the use of carbon-intensive products is maintained. And that goes for households as well as it does for industry.
But he says handing out checks, as the government did with some of its stimulus spending, should be avoided.
The checks in the mail ought to be the last resort for households, for people that you can't otherwise reach with reductions in other taxes.
The climate change minister, Greg Combey, says he hasn't yet read the ANU paper, but welcomes contributions to the carbon pricing debate.
Later this week, Professor Garner will issue what will be an important paper as well on carbon pricing. So the announcement that the government made recently about the framework for carbon prices stimulating a lot of discussion, that's what it was intended to do.
He's trying to turn the attention back to the opposition leader. Tony Abbott told a community forum in Perth yesterday that the science on climate change isn't settled. Greg Combey says he's reverting to type.
Clearly he doesn't accept the climate science.
On DMG radio this morning, Mr. Abbott was stressing that he and his party believe action should be taken to mitigate climate change.
Well, we do need to do something about emissions, and the coalition's position, Leon, is that climate change is real. Humanity is making a contribution. It's important to have a strong and effective policy to try to bring emissions down, and that's what we're doing.
And his deputy, Julie Bishop, told Macquarie Radio that there's been no shift in the opposition's policy.
It's a non-controversial statement to make. Science is never settled. Science is always being challenged, and so it should be. That's a fundamental aspect of science. It's never settled. It should always be challenged.
And that's the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, Julie Bishop, ending Naomi Wood. Please report. Six Queensland police officers involved in a botched investigation into an Aboriginal death in custody won't face disciplinary charges. Cameron Doomadgee died in the Palm Island Watch House in 2004, and there have been several investigations into his death. Last year, the Crime and Misconduct Commission was critical of an internal police review of the handling of the case, and it recommended disciplinary charges against the officers involved. As Karen Binney reports.
It's been 7 years since Cameron Doomadgee died in the Palm Island Watch House. There's been three inquests and a number of investigations into who was responsible. Senior Sergeant Chris Hurley has faced trial and has been found not guilty of manslaughter and assault. A report also examined the initial police investigation, and there was an internal police review. Last year, Queensland's Crime and Misconduct Commission was critical, finding both were flawed and recommended disciplinary charges against six police officers.
The reality is that it's taken in excess of 6 years for this weak non-conclusion to be reached over a simple allegation that Sergeant Hurley's mates were called in to investigate him.
Terry O'Gorman is from the Queensland Council for Civil Liberties.
The system has broken down. The reality is that any system that takes six years to say, well, we really can't do anything about Sergeant Hurley's mates being called in to investigate him and to wine and dine with him before they supposedly start an investigation into deaths in custody, if this was a complaint system that operated in some of the tin pot dictatorships around the world, we'd shake our head, go tut tut, and say, aren't we so much better? We're not.
The ABC understands that Deputy Police Commissioner Cathy Rinders has rejected the CMC's recommendation that six investigators face disciplinary charges. Instead, the officers involved will face only managerial guidance. The CMC chairman, Martin Moynihan, is expected to reveal this afternoon that a legal loophole prevents the corruption watchdog from appealing that decision. It's understood the CMC could only challenge Commissioner Rinders' decision if there was a formal disciplinary process. Mr. O'Gorman says the case raises questions about the police complaint system.
Well, we wouldn't allow it in our financial institutions. We wouldn't allow it in any other state government department in Queensland. The reality is the complaint system in Queensland has completely lost credibility.
The Queensland Police Union President Ian Leavers agrees there are problems with the discipline system, but he's also critical of the CMC's handling of the investigation.
That being the case, it is a common sense decision because we all knew right from the start there was never any evidence of official misconduct by the investigating police into this matter. What it does show is the incompetence and the inability of the CMC to do anything right. They, right at the outset of this, had not only the moral obligation, but the ability and the legislation which enabled them to take over their investigation, and they did nothing.
But the CMC found last year that there was enough evidence to bring disciplinary charges against those officers.
Absolutely, I dispute that. And they know full well from this investigation there was no evidence.
The ABC understands the CMC chairman will ask for legislative changes to allow the watchdog to challenge police discipline decisions.
Karen Binney reporting, and that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a great afternoon.
Pacific Beat, we've started something different. Every Thursday afternoon, we're opening up the phone lines. SMS your comments about the topic of the day. You can also SMS your phone number and we'll try to get you on the air. The number is 61427-727272. That's 61427-727272. Join the conversation every Thursday afternoon with Pacific Beat on Radio Australia.